Tonight, as I promised, we're going to finish the book of Genesis. And we are in the story of Joseph. And remember, last week, Joseph went through that prefigurement of Christ's passion, being wrongly accused and thrown into prison. He was actually thrown into prison for being a righteous man. Potiphar's wife wanted to have relations with him. He refused because to him it was a sin, but to her it was no sin. He was being righteous, but Egyptian culture was so upside down that demanding sex from a slave was considered normal. And so he was thrown into prison for being righteous. He was there for 3 years before he came out of prison. Prefiguring Christ, who had been betrayed, as Joseph was betrayed by his brothers, Christ was betrayed by his disciple. Christ suffered for his righteousness. Christ was in the tomb for 3 days, as Joseph was in prison for 3 years. And then, as Christ was raised to glory, Joseph was raised to be the vizier of Egypt. And because of his interpretation of Pharaoh's dream about the coming famine, Pharaoh puts him in charge of the granaries, of collecting the grain, preparing for the famine, and then of dispensing the grain once the famine had begun. Now, the famine was extremely large. It did not just affect Egypt, but probably all of North Africa and the Middle East. And certainly in Canaan, they are now suffering from this famine, and they need grain. Jacob is there and realizes that he needs grain. He hears that there's grain in Egypt. So he sends his sons, not all of them, all right, because he keeps Benjamin back. Of course, Joseph, he thinks, is dead. Holds Benjamin back. Benjamin was the youngest. Joseph's full brother, the rest of them are Joseph's half-brother, sends them to Egypt, and they want to buy grain. Joseph immediately recognizes them, but they don't recognize Joseph. He's dressed like an Egyptian, and you've seen pictures of how, you know, with the fancy beards and the headdress, and the, you know, and he's dressed unusually. He's speaking Egyptian. He's not speaking Hebrew to them. And they realize, they don't have any idea who he is. But he immediately accuses them of being spies. Now you can imagine what's going through Joseph's heart right now. These are the men who sold him into slavery. And he has both the means of putting them all to death. He's the vizier of Egypt. He can kill them in an instant, and no one will ask a question. And at some level, perhaps he has the desire for revenge, for vengeance, for how they treated him. But he at least is going to test them. He doesn't let them know that he can understand their language. He's speaking Egyptian, they're speaking Hebrew. And he overhears them talking, and Reuben says, "I told you not to do this." Remember, Reuben was the one who tried to save Joseph's life. "I told you that God would punish us if we shed innocent blood the way we did, the way we killed our brother Joseph." So Joseph is now, for the first time, kind of getting the whole story. And he becomes overwhelmed with emotion. He goes out and weeps. And so he begins to question them about their lives, about their fathers. Do you have a father? Is he still alive? Do you have any brothers? He's trying to find out about Benjamin, his brother. He discovers that, yes, his father is still alive. Yes, brother Benjamin is doing well. And so he says, "I tell you what, you'll leave one person behind. The rest of you go back and come back with your brother Benjamin and your father, so I'll know that you are telling the truth." He wants to see his brother Benjamin again. Well, they go back to Canaan and relay this to their father Jacob, who refuses to send his youngest son Benjamin to Egypt. He says, Jacob is gone, Simeon, the one who was, excuse me, Joseph is gone, Simeon, the one who Joseph held held back, sending the other sons to Jacob. He's gone. Now you want to take Benjamin and kill him too. My gray hairs will go down to Sheol in sadness. Now, just in case anybody doesn't understand what Sheol is, Sheol, it was the ancient Hebrew concept of the place for the dead. And it turns up in the New Testament, it's referred to, and when Jesus gives the parable of the poor man Lazarus, who died and went into Abraham's bosom, and the rich man who wouldn't take care of him, wouldn't feed him, he dies and he goes into the other side of Sheol. So Sheol is like this blanket underworld where you have the wicked on one side and you have the righteous on the other. And the righteous was referred to as Abraham's bosom. But all those who died would go into Sheol. How you were treated in Sheol would depend upon how you lived your life. But everybody goes to the same place. Not quite the same concept we have now of heaven and hell. But Jesus, realizing this, when he is teaching, he teaches, I am going to prepare a place. So he is explaining to them that the old concept of Sheol is to be replaced to where we now go into the place of God. We experience the joy, the beatific vision. We enjoy heaven forever with God. The Jews did not have that concept. They were sitting in this underworld altogether. So, just so you understand what Sheol is. Eventually, the grain runs out. Jacob says, all right, we must do something. So he agrees to let Benjamin go. Jacob still stays behind. Judah promises to renounce his inheritance if he does not bring Benjamin back safely. So that's how he gets Jacob to give him. He says, I'll put my inheritance on the line. I promise I will bring him back. But they're very nervous because when they left Egypt the first time, Joseph not only sold them the grain, he also snuck in their payment. He did not want to accept payment from his brothers. So he snuck it back into their bags. They discovered that on the way back, and they were very nervous because now they're afraid that the vizier of Egypt will not only accuse them of being spies, but also accuse them of being thieves because they took their payment back. Well, they do make it back. They bring a double portion of payment so they can pay back the first portion plus the new portion. They come back with Benjamin. Joseph sees them. He frees Simeon and he begins to weep. He begins to weep so loudly that it's heard far and wide. They hold a banquet, and Benjamin is given a double portion at the banquet because of the close relationship between Joseph and Benjamin. And at some point they say, why are you crying? And he says, because I'm Joseph, your brother. So immediately they are terrified. They fall to the ground. Please don't kill us. But you remember in his dream, that was his dream, that his brothers were going to lie prostrate before him. And so this is that fulfillment of the dream. And they say, please don't kill us. And he says, no, that is, you don't understand. This was God's plan. You intended it for evil, but God intended it for good. God sent me here ahead of you so that the world could be saved. A lot of times when God is going to do something powerful in our lives, we have to go through the same kind of death and resurrection that Christ went through to bring about the redemption of the world. It's what Abraham went through for these years and years of waiting for the fulfillment of his promise without having children. So what Joseph goes through, being wrongly accused and put in prison for 3 years before he comes out, so that he can do this powerful work of God. And we need to get to that point where we can say, all right, maybe somebody intended this for evil in my life. But God has intended it for good. God has worked good. And the way that the Hebrew nation was saved, it was through Joseph's forgiveness. Joseph forgave his brothers. And when I'll read that passage from Matthew. And I sometimes wonder, when Peter's asking this question, is he thinking about Joseph? How many times do I have to forgive my brother? You know, if my brother sins against me, how many times do I have to forgive him? I didn't grow up with a brother, all right? I had a sister, and I didn't have brothers. And we're a Protestant family, we were just two of us, so. But, I mean, I've witnessed brothers and the conflicts that they have. But one of the nice things about watching brothers grow up is their forgiveness of each other. Because there are always these conflicts between them, but they're always getting to that point of forgiveness. And Peter's asking that question, how many times do I have to forgive my brother? And in different gospels, sometimes it's 77, this is another 77, sometimes it's 70 times 7. It was just supposed to be this enormous number. You don't stop. You can't keep count. You're not keeping count. You're just going. You just keep forgiving. The way God forgives us. And sometimes we don't know if the difficulties we experience are in fact a means of God creating a greater blessing. You've heard me say again and again, God doesn't get angry and punish you. If bad things happen to you, it's not God punishing you. But sometimes when bad things happen, it's God directing you. It's God bringing you to a point where what he wants to have accomplished can be accomplished. And then Jacob comes back. Jacob eventually comes down to Egypt along with the entire tribe, all 70 men of the tribe. And there they settle in the land of Goshen and they prosper. And the last thing that happens is Jacob is going to bless his 12 sons. And those blessings are very interesting. They're in your notes. I won't go through them line by line. But he gives to each, the head of each tribe, a blessing, which in fact is itself a prophecy of what's going to happen with the descendants of that son of Israel. Each of these sons becomes one of the 12 tribes of Israel. These are the names of the 12 tribes. And each of the 12 tribes, when they get into the promised land, will have their own spot, their own place in the promised land. And then Jacob dies, and Joseph takes his body back to the ancestral cave in what is current day Hebron, the cave of Machpelah that is opposite Mamre. And then as we close Genesis, Joseph dies, but he stays in Egypt. Now, a quick archaeological note. We actually know where all this took place. We have excavations in what is the ancient town of Avaris, which was in the area that was known as Goshen in the Bible. We actually have excavated the house of Joseph. We know where Joseph lived. Joseph was buried in a pyramid. There is a statue of Joseph wearing a coat of many colors. And he is presented as the vizier of Egypt. And there are the tombs of the other patriarchs saw the sons of Jacob each have a smaller tomb there, not a pyramid, but a gravesite there at Joseph's compound. All this is visible. The granaries are all there. You can see the granaries and how they're interconnected so they could move grain from one area to another. It is fascinating the amount of the material that is there to support, archaeologically support this story. Did I include this little timeline? I think I'd include the timeline in your notes.
Yeah.
This timeline, and I'm going to touch on this real briefly. Kind of shows how this story that we've just finished in the book of Genesis compares to the Egyptian history, how it matches and fits into Egyptian history. And we talked a little bit about Abraham, his visit to Egypt, Joseph and Sennacherib III, who was the pharaoh who took over ownership of all of Egypt. Prior to him, Egypt was not owned by Pharaoh. It was Joseph who made that possible by the saving of the grain and then selling it back to the people. But then after this, there comes it's very interesting, for a period of about 150 years, after the death of Joseph, Egypt is ruled by a Semitic people called the Hyksos. We don't know anything about them at all, really. They're probably not the Hebrews. My guess would be Hittites, maybe Assyrians. But a Semitic group of people ruled Egypt for years, and they had their capital. One of their capitals was in Avaris, the place where Joseph's compound was and his pyramid is. Now, as when we get into Genesis, we're going to hear this phrase: there arose a Pharaoh in Egypt who did not know Joseph. And that probably relates to the overthrow of the Hyksos, when the Egyptians regained their country. They were occupied and ruled by Hyksos pharaohs for about 150 years. And then the Egyptians retook their country. And at that point, the Semitic people, which the Hebrews would have just been lumped into this collection, the Semites who were living in Egypt, they despised the Hyksos because the Hyksos had occupied them for 150 years. And it's at this point that the Hebrews, the Semites who lived there, were likely enslaved. And when we begin to see the development of the story of Moses, why are they killing all the Hebrews? They're killing all the Semites. Again, because of this dreadful anger they had towards the Hyksos occupation for that period. And then eventually we're going to get to the Exodus. And I think your notes go all the way through to the dating of that Exodus.